Today is Thursday, July 8th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinua Adofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, manhunt underway for killers of Haiti's president.
Haiti police have killed four people suspected in the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse, the police chief announced Wednesday, and two more have been arrested.
Plus, U.S. considers expedited visas for at-risk Afghanistan citizens.
Human rights groups are calling for up to 2,000 visas specifically for vulnerable women and women's advocates.
Also, rapes and abuses continue in Tigray despite ceasefire. Our top story today is in Haiti. Haiti's security forces on Wednesday battled heavily armed assailants who assassinated President Jovenel Moïse at his home overnight, plunging the already impoverished, violence-racked nation deeper into chaos. Gloria So of Reuters reports.
Haiti police have killed four people suspected in the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse, the police chief announced Wednesday, and two more have been arrested. The government has declared a two-week state of emergency as it chases down the killers who shot Moïse dead in his home in Port-au-Prince overnight. Haiti Police Chief Leon Charles said Wednesday they had blocked the assassins as they were leaving the crime scene and had been locked in a standoff with them since. Moïse's wife Martine was also shot and severely wounded and has received medical treatment. Haiti's ambassador to the United States told Reuters the gunmen were masquerading as U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration agents, a move that would likely have helped them gain entry to Moïse's guarded residence. Interim Prime Minister Claude Joseph has called for calm across the country, the poorest nation in the Americas. Bustling streets were deserted Wednesday as vehicles transporting Moïse's body to the morgue were rerouted due to gunshots and roadblocks. Moïse's assassination came amid calls for his resignation over corruption allegations, economic mismanagement, and his tightening grip on power. The nation of 11 million has grappled with political unrest for decades and faces a surge in gang violence and a growing humanitarian crisis. The United States, Haiti's top aid donor, was quick to condemn Moïse's assassination and vowed to promote peace and security in the region. Meanwhile, the Dominican Republic closed the border it shares with Haiti in anticipation of violent unrest. The UN Security Council is set to evaluate the situation in a closed-door meeting on Thursday.
Haiti's ambassador to the United States, Bokishid Edmond, says professional killers who were speaking Spanish fatally shot President Jovenel Moïse Wednesday morning and most likely escaped over the land border to the Dominican Republic if they are not still in the country. He appealed to the international community for help to find and bring them to justice, as VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Haitian security forces are patrolling the capital, Port-au-Prince, near the private residence of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse, where he was assassinated Wednesday morning in an attack that left his wife wounded. The city was quiet and residents said they were shocked, despite gang violence and political instability that plagues the country. Haiti's ambassador to the United States, Bokshi Edmond, told reporters that First Lady Martine Moïse is in stable but critical condition. He appealed to all Haitians to unite after the assassination. And he appealed to the international community to help find the killers and to help Haiti protect itself in the future.
We need to have an armed forces because our country was created by military. So it is very important to have that, and so our borders can be protected and to have a better control over the borders, because it is unacceptable to have a foreign commandos to enter a country, to kill a president and to leave without any concern. I don't think any international partners should be part of this.
World leaders also reacted with shock to the news, including U.S. President Joe Biden.
We need a lot more information, but it's very worrisome about the state of Haiti.
Ask if there is any appetite in the Biden administration for an intervention in Haiti, as the U.S. has done previously in times of political turmoil in the Caribbean nation. State Department spokesperson Ned Price had this to say.
To us, Matt, Haiti is a partner, and that is how we'll treat this relationship. It is how we have treated Haiti. It is how we will going forward.
Price said the U.S. would echo the words of Haiti's acting prime minister, Claude Joseph, who has appealed for calm in the face of economic desperation and escalating gang violence. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
The Biden administration is considering offering an expedited visa path for vulnerable Afghans, including women, politicians, journalists, and activists who may become targets of the Taliban, U.S. officials say. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
Women politicians, journalists, and activists continue to face intimidation, discrimination, and violence. Human rights groups are calling for up to 2,000 visas specifically for vulnerable women and women's advocates. After the US military pullout of Afghanistan this month, advocacy groups have urged the White House to develop a plan to evacuate thousands, which include those who have worked with foreign forces and translators. One of the officials also said men and minorities working in high-risk professions are also being considered. The White House declined to comment, but US President Joe Biden said he will speak on Afghanistan on Thursday. Women police officers, media workers, judges, and medical workers have been assassinated in Afghanistan as foreign military have left the country. Women who appear on TV and radio face particular threats, Human Rights Watch wrote in April. Under the Taliban, women were barred from education or work, required to fully cover their bodies, and could not leave home without a male relative.
That's Libby Hogan of Reuters. Hundreds of women and girls in Ethiopia's Tigray region have reported brutal rapes at the hands of soldiers in a war that is still ongoing despite last week's government troop withdrawal. As VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Mekelle, the rape victims who come forward say there are only a small percentage of the women and girls who have been brutalized.
Hospital administrators in Tigray say because of the ongoing war, it is often too late for rape survivors to get help to prevent pregnancy or disease. The women are also gravely wounded, both physically and mentally.
When you see especially women who've been raped by many men, and when you see them, and before you talk to them, they have to be carried out of their room. They can't walk.
Atsbaha says the real impact of these attacks cannot be measured medically, as they ruin lives, families, and entire communities. War in Tigray broke out last November between the federal government and Tigrayan fighters. The battles took an abrupt turn last week when the federal government declared a unilateral ceasefire. Federal forces left Tigray, they claim, for tactical and humanitarian reasons. Tigray forces say they drove them out. But the humanitarian crisis continues to deepen in Tigray, with thousands killed and millions displaced. Some 400,000 people are believed to be suffering from famine, and 1.8 million more living on the brink of famine. Activists say widespread sexual violence against Tigrayan women is integral to the conflict that is still ongoing. And at the hospital in Mekelle, counselors say only a small percentage of victims seek help.
One survivor says over 20 survivors are raped at the time, but they can't come to this.
Victims don't come forward because they are trapped in war zones, afraid of stigma, or fearful the soldiers who raped them will attack them again if they are reported. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Mekelle, Ethiopia.
UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet warns Myanmar could plunge into war as despair among the civilian population rises in the wake of the military coup in February. The High Commissioner's report is being discussed as part of a special interactive dialogue on Myanmar at the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA in Geneva.
More than 5 months have passed since Myanmar's military leaders derailed the country's fragile democracy. UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet says what began as a coup by the Myanmar military has rapidly morphed into an attack against the civilian population. She says nearly 900 people have been killed and some 200,000 forced to flee from increasingly violent military raids on neighborhoods and villages. She warns the widespread and systematic assaults against civilians risk sparking a broader civil war. She says despair is rising.
Some people in many parts of Myanmar have taken up arms and formed self-protection groups. These newly formed armed opposition groups have launched attacks in several locations to which the security forces have responded with disproportionate force. I am concerned that this escalation in violence could have horrific consequences for civilians.
Bachelet notes the coup has exacerbated several long-running conflicts in Myanmar's borderlands. She says fighting has resumed in Kachin, Kayin, and northern Shan states. She adds Chin and Kaya states, which have been largely peaceful in recent years, have taken up arms again. The High Commissioner warns Myanmar's political crisis has evolved into a multidimensional human rights catastrophe. This, she says, is causing inestimable suffering for the population and is devastating prospects for sustainable development. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A former U.S. President Donald Trump has announced class action lawsuits against three major tech companies, accusing them of wrongfully censoring him and other conservatives. Nancy Costello is director of the First Amendment Law Clinic at Michigan State University's College of Law. She explained to International Edition's Steve Miller the legal definitions of government-protected, quote, free speech, unquote.
The First Amendment does not apply to private companies or any private entities. The First Amendment has to have a government actor, meaning that what the First Amendment does is it protects Americans from the government regulating speech or censoring your speech. And what Trump is claiming is that Facebook and Twitter have violated his First Amendment rights. But Twitter and Facebook are not the government. And so the First Amendment doesn't apply here. When you're a private entity, a private news organization, you can decide exactly what kind of news content you have. You can decide to regulate the speech on that platform. You can decide to ban the speech. You could decide not to have someone's speech proclaimed at all on a platform. And that is within their rights to do that. The First Amendment does not apply.
So can you help explain this? Because not long ago, there was a lawsuit that said that President Trump could not block certain followers on Twitter because it would infringe upon their free speech. Can you kind of explain what was exactly going on there?
So as it wasn't a private account for him. He was speaking as the president of the United States on his Twitter account and perhaps Facebook too. And then he blocked people who were criticizing him on his Twitter account. Well, he is the government. He's the president. So there is a governmental actor here, and therefore the First Amendment would apply, and you can't just censor speech like that as the government, and you can't regulate speech like that, because he is the government. That's the difference. Twitter and Facebook are not the government, they're private entities.
You know, speaking about private entities and what is a government, there have been calls that big tech companies become regulated like public utilities. Would that in any way, shape, or form change the discussion or the parameters in which the First Amendment would apply to companies like Facebook?
I don't think so. I don't want to speak out of turn here in terms of communications law, which is not exactly my bailiwick. But what the First Amendment regulates is speech and expression. And utilities, public utilities, are not involved in that business of expression and speech. And so the First Amendment would not apply to public utilities. It doesn't mean that in some ways the government cannot regulate speech, but they have to do it in very narrow ways that they can't shut down speech entirely. And they can't shut it down based on content. And so because public utilities are not in the job or in the position of expressing anything, I don't see how the First Amendment would apply in that way. I think that the types of rules that we're talking about here are different because we're specifically talking about regulation of expression, and that's not the kind of business public utilities are involved in.
That's Nancy Costello, director of the First Amendment Law Clinic at Michigan State University's College of Law, speaking with my colleague, Steve Miller. This is the Voice of America. Iraqi security forces say rockets have landed in and around the heavily fortified Green Zone in the Iraqi capital Baghdad, which houses the U.S. embassy, causing material damage. two Katyusha rockets fell near the National Security Building and in an open court outside the Green Zone early Thursday. A third rocket fell in a nearby residential area, damaging a civilian vehicle. The attack, which came shortly before daybreak, followed two separate attacks on bases housing U.S. troops in western Iraq and across the border in Syria, where U.S.-led coalition forces are based. The European Union has fined four major German car manufacturers $1 billion because they colluded to limit the development and rollout of car emission control systems. The European Commission said Thursday that Daimler, BMW, Volkswagen, Audi and Porsche avoided competing on technology to restrict pollution from gasoline and diesel passenger cars. Daimler wasn't fined after it revealed the cartel to the EU Commission. You are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Former South African President Jacob Zuma is behind bars on Thursday after turning himself over to police to begin serving a 15-month prison term. Shortly before the midnight deadline for the police to arrest him, Zuma left his Nkandla home in a convoy of vehicles. The nation's highest legislative body, the Constitutional Court, sentenced him to prison for contempt of court for refusing to testify about allegations of massive graft during his time in office. He's denied any wrongdoing. Reporter Darren Taylor has the details from Johannesburg.
Political commentator Oliver Dixon, who was at Zuma's home at Nkandla in KwaZulu-Natal province, says there were signs late last night that the former president was giving up his fight to avoid jail.
But it was quite clear that the most likely thing Jacob Zuma was going to do was to hand himself over to avoid an arrest. An arrest would be humiliating, an arrest would be a spectacle, an arrest would not...
One of Zuma's most vociferous allies, his comrade in the ANC's Liberation Army, Carl Niehaus, told reporters at Nkandla that the former president was being treated disgracefully.
The South African police service wanting to rush in and arrest President Zuma is just a further indication of the vindictiveness against him and the lack of care. We believe
there's evidence before the Commission of Inquiry that Zuma and his allies stole billions of dollars from government corporations when he led South Africa between 2009 and 2018. Zuma maintains he's an innocent victim of a political conspiracy led by the current president, Cyril Ramaphosa. Nevertheless, shortly before midnight, Zuma left his home in a convoy of black SUVs which sped past ululating supporters. He was taken to nearby Estcourt prison to begin serving his sentence. Singabako Ngomalo is a spokesman for South Africa's Correctional Services Department. He says the next step in Zuma's induction to life as an inmate will primarily involve an assessment of his health. The former president claims he's suffering from a variety of illnesses.
All newly admitted inmates are not mixed up with the general inmate population. They get isolated for 14 days. This is to check whether they do not have COVID-19 or any other illness for that matter. And once...
Nkrumalo says a prison psychologist will also assess Zuma's mental health and whether he's a suicide risk. He emphasizes that Zuma won't get any special privileges. Nkrumalo suggests, however, that because Zuma's so high profile, he cannot be jailed among the general prisoners.
What is key is that all inmates must be kept in a safe and secure environment. Remember, in this particular case, Mr. Zuma is not in a position to go there with the protection that he has been having, you know, as the former state president. So,
Zuma's imprisonment follows days of tension at Nkandla when his supporters, some armed with automatic rifles and other firearms, threatened bloodshed should the police try to arrest their hero. Leader of the opposition Democratic Alliance, John Steenhuisen, welcomes Zuma's incarceration as a triumph for the people.
Mr. Zuma spent a number of months
making derogatory comments about the Constitutional Court, making spurious allegations against the justices and various other members of the judiciary. And I think this sends it a very, very strong message that the law won't be mocked in South Africa and that it will be applied. I mean, we have to have that. We have to be a law and rules-based society. Otherwise, you descend into chaos.
Zuma, though, has another shot at freedom on Monday when the Constitutional Court will hear his appeal. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
A UN panel of experts warned that while Syria's 10-year-old civil conflict may have fallen out of the world's media spotlight, the fighting and suffering of millions of people is far from over. The three-member independent International Commission of Inquiry on Syria has submitted its latest report to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Syria no longer is subject to the wholesale killings of civilians, to chemical weapons attacks, to the carpet bombing of cities and other atrocities that have ravaged this once vibrant land. Nevertheless, the three-member Commission of Inquiry warns the war continues in earnest in some places and simmers in others, while civilians are abused with impunity. Additionally, Commission Chair Paolo Pinheiro says Syria's civil strife has long ago ceased to be a homemade struggle between the Assad government and its domestic opponents. He says Syria is up for grabs by powerful countries who seek to exert influence in the region.
Five international armies, their proxies, and a plethora of other non-state actors continue to fight in Syria to this day, including the Air Force of the Russian Federation, the United States, and Israel. Civilians must navigate through all of these actors and their conflicting agendas as they simply attempt to go about their lives.
The most critical situation is in Idlib Governorate in northwest Syria. Pinheiro says more than 2.7 million internally displaced people there are living in desperate conditions. He says they are at risk of violence from the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham terrorist group and Turkish and Syrian troops. The commission report describes unstable conditions in many parts of the country where improvised explosive devices are killing and maiming scores of civilians. It documents rampant violations of human rights, such as arbitrary detention of civilians, including women and children, torture, forced conscription of child soldiers, assassination of medical workers, and the looting and appropriation of property. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
China has accused Australia of, quote, interfering, unquote, with its efforts to boost the COVID-19 vaccine program in Papua New Guinea. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Chinese state-owned media has claimed that Australian consultants in Papua New Guinea have been hindering the rollout of COVID-19 vaccines flown in from China. It was alleged that they'd engaged in political manipulation and bullying there. Australia has strongly denied claims it's tried to sabotage China's efforts to boost vaccinations in Papua New Guinea. Papua New Guinea is currently using the AstraZeneca vaccine. 200,000 doses of the Sinopharm vaccine have recently been flown in from China, but have yet to be approved for use by local authorities. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson warned Australia to stop interfering with and undermining vaccine cooperation between China and Pacific Island countries. Australia's Minister for the Pacific, Zed Seselja, told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation all international assistance is welcome. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
International Olympic Committee President Thomas Bach has arrived in Tokyo as Japan's Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga announced a state of emergency that could result in a ban on fans at the Tokyo Games as coronavirus infections spread across the capital. Bach's arrival comes just 2 weeks before the Olympics are set to open after a year's postponement. Government officials have proposed a plan to issue a state of emergency in Tokyo from Monday through August 22nd. The Olympics are to begin on July 23rd and close August 8th. The Paralympics open on August 24th. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Paul Alexander, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.